Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very accomplished professional from the world of academia and an author, Professor Payal Kumar from New Delhi, India. Payal, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashutosh. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Professor Kumar is the Principal Academic Advisor of the Indian School of Hospitality, India. So before we start talking about what you're doing as a leader, tell me about your journey. And you've described yourself as an accidental professor.
So, I mean, I've been in various professions, various industries. The very first profession I had was I was a trained journalist. I came from England, from Manchester to Patna. Can you believe it? Mm-hmm. And then after that, 10 years of working in Hindustan Times, I joined the publishing sector. I was vice president, editorial and production at Sage Publication, which is the well-known social science publisher. So when I was in my fourth year, I was there for 6 years, I started itching to learn more. And I started doing my PhD with no intention of going into academics. It was just for my own learning. But I think something shifted within me. And I then ended up completely leaving the corporate sector and going into academics full time.
So, you told me that you moved from the corporate world to an academic role. How has this transition shaped you personally?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think when you're trained as a corporate leader, you're trained to, of course, work in a very fast pace, a high stressful, deadline driven environment. But you're also trained to be a solution finder, isn't it? Constantly there are problems, constantly you're finding solutions, processes, hiring the right people and all that kind of thing. Now, academia, when you go into academics, is a very different way of thinking. So I think, corporate obviously helped me with academia in the sense that I became very deadline driven and all that kind of stuff. But I think academia, the world is a lot more conceptual. You look at the bigger picture. So you have to learn, you have to unlearn stuff, and then you have to learn a different way of thinking. So it has shaped me. I mean, I think I've calm down a lot more. I don't, constantly think of solutions, although that's my training. I mean, it comes as a natural thing, but I try and look at, theory, at more conceptual ideas, the larger picture. So I have changed my way of thinking, I believe.
Fascinating. And, I've known many people who have made this transition. My question to you is, what were some of the initial challenges you encountered when you entered the world of academia?
So I think when I finally decided to quit my vice president job and to, focus fully on the PhD, it was quite horrifying, Asantosh, in the sense that, you don't have a visiting card as a doctoral scholar. You're an unknown person, if you know what I mean, right? So from being well known to, and I honestly felt as though I was in a wide ocean on a small boat and I'm not quite sure where I'm drifting. It's that nebulous of an environment where I was used to working in a very structured environment for various companies and various industries. So it was really, really difficult. And in the scholarship when I was doing the actual PhD, and that too, as you would know, a PhD journey doesn't have much structure later on after the coursework. It's like where you go, what literature you read.
Right.
But then when I did join the academics, after my PhD as a professor, there were some challenges, of course, but I didn't find it too difficult. I managed to, get onto leadership track very quickly and didn't find too much difficulty in the job-wise part. There's a shift of identity. So that, so you're really high in terms of leadership, then you go to a low ebb and you got to have that self-belief,
Correct.
And then you come up again, hopefully, on the other side.
Yeah, well said, well said. And how have all the learnings in the corporate world contributed to your success in academia?
So like I said, we become so deadline and performance driven. So I think that's really helped me. So for example, currently I'm working on writing 5 books and people say to me, how do you do that at the same time? So I have various networks of scholars around the world and we're working on 5 projects, apart from many other things, from papers, international conferences, et cetera. So I think the fact that I can, grapple so many things at the same time is thanks to my corporate training. But like I said, you have to also unlearn a lot of things. Although I must add, we're talking very seriously, but let me add that my grown-up children say to me, you've been in various industries, various leadership positions, but we always knew you'd end up a professor because you've given us so many lectures in your life.
Well said, well said. So moving on now, Payal, my next question is, and when I was reading about you, it was interesting that you have a lot of interest in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Tell me, how did this interest develop and how does it influence your work today?
So I was brought up in England, in the 70s and 80s, when it was a dark period, especially when you go further up north, like in Manchester, there's a lot of racism in the schools. We all faced it as 3 children. We all faced it to quite some extent. That really shaped our lives and our, so by the time I was 18, I had very little self-esteem, didn't really believe in myself until I went to university and met many different communities and cultures. So, it has shaped me. And so constantly I've been doing research on diversity without even thinking about it, just, it's just what I do. So apart from a lot of research on gender equity, but I also do things like, leadership, followership, DEI in different ways. So I've just done a paper which has been published in a FT50 journal, really proud about that, a journal of business ethics, on, you need to draw on Eastern religious thinking to perhaps manage DEI better in the workplace. So it's just been there throughout my research, I think maybe because I was influenced, I had certain childhood experiences, felt equity is so important.
And have you written a lot about DEI also?
Yes. I mean, I call myself a DEI scholar.
Fascinating.
So the interesting thing is, Asantosh, in DEI scholarship, or practitioners even, like companies roll out all these best diversity practices. But the problem is diversity doesn't necessarily lead to inclusion, isn't it? So you could hire somebody who's wheelchair bound, but not everybody may want to sit with that person in the lunchtime. So I think it's a very broad issue that needs to be taken into consideration.
Absolutely. I've spoken to many leaders on my podcast, many women leaders, and I've asked them this question that, you are sitting in a board, but do you have a voice? And they say no. So, there is a lot of work needed to be done.
So again, research has shown that if you put a token number of women into a boardroom, it doesn't really help. So one of my books, in fact, was Gender Equity in the Boardroom in India. And I found that in spite of the 2013 Companies Act, which stipulates that you have to have a certain number of women, in spite of that, a lot of companies, they'll put in the mother or the sister, like a token representation, not all, of course. But, this doesn't really help. But research has shown that if you put a sizable number of women in the boardroom, profits go up. There are many positive outcome variables, including profits go up and, the way the company's looked at, the reputation goes up and so many things. So we still have to get there a long way to get there.
But you're absolutely right, because that's been my experience as well, that, women definitely have a much, much better, and I'm saying it on my podcast, a much stronger work ethic.
Not only that, there's a beautiful, there's an amazing professor, Corinne Post, who does a lot of research on women and boards. She's even discovered that if there's a lot of women in a board in a pharmaceutical company, they will withdraw a dangerous drug like 10 times faster than if it was an all-male board. So it's not just about profits, it's also about people,
Very well said, well said. Well, my next question is, what unique perspectives does Indian-centric research bring to global academic discussions? Because you've written a lot of papers.
Right. So a lot of my research is about the Indian story. You're absolutely right. So although I keep flitting across many subjects, so I could be doing a book or a paper on social entrepreneur, on gender equity, on leadership, followership, I've been going all around the place, mentorship. but very often the Indian story is there. So for example, my PhD was on mentoring, negative mentoring experiences of the protege, and the six handbooks I read, like Sage and Routledge and whatever, they all spoke of the Western story, which is fine, but I always used to feel this is incomplete. So then I did a handbook with Professor Pavan Budwar, who's the Pro Vice Chancellor at Aston University in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. We did it on Asian mentoring experiences, which we found were, you know, a little bit more unique, nuanced. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important, and publishers are realizing this now. So I published with Emerald Springer, Palgrave Macmillan, Rupa. And earlier, you know, say 10, 15 years ago, people were interested in the Western story. Now they're hankering for books on India, the Indian story, you know, because it's one of the fastest growing economies. We've got the largest Gen Y. Mm. We've got such a young demographic. There's so many unique things happening here. Mm. And you can't just copy paste everything that's happening in the West onto the Asian work, you know, environment, I feel.
Very true. Well said.
Answered your question.
Absolutely. And you also lived and worked in several countries. How has these experiences shaped your academic and professional perspectives?
So I was born in Zambia. My father was sent there by the British government to set up one of the first radiology departments. And then we went to Fiji, and then he brought us to England. And then I decided to come and settle in India. Definitely. I mean, it's made me, I feel I'm a global citizen. Mm-hmm. I can very easily, like I said, I'm working with five teams of scholars, you know, Europe, Canada, US, Asia. So I can talk to people so easily. I feel it's definitely increased empathy. Mm-hmm. A cultural quotient, hopefully, is high. And it also makes you realize that, you know, you need to respect the other. Mm-hmm. So you may find that your way of life is good for you, but, you know, everybody has different way of life.
Right.
So something which may be regarded as normatively wrong in India may not be seen as wrong in some other country, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So kind of it brings about an innate respect for cultures, I feel.
Thank you.
I think travel is the best education.
Absolutely right. I agree completely. So I have two more questions before I move to your books. My next question is, how has technology influenced your own teaching and research methodologies?
So I feel, Asantosh, that these days it's very, you know, difficult for professors. So, you know, the old style of PPT and giving a Harvard Business Review pre-read, I think those days are gone. And because we're competing with things like YouTube, right? Mm. So I think the very first thing that professors have to do is grab the eyeballs of the students. In other words, you got to be entertaining. I speak to a lot of friends of mine who are actors, you know, to get advice from them. How do you hold an audience for an hour and a half, you know, like that? So we're competing with technology in a sense. So I think that's brought about, I've brought in a lot more forms of pedagogy, different forms of teaching into my classroom, experiential games and things like that, you know, not just PPT and stand-up teaching.
Right.
And obviously, we also teach online through Zoom and all that. And I also train professors to bring in all these different forms of pedagogy. Because I think the first thing is to make the classroom entertaining, whether we like it or not.
Right.
Only then students will learn, and then we'll have the learning outcomes, hopefully. And then also, I've been using ChatGPT extensively. I do workshops, again, both for professors and for the corporate sector. You need a different kind of training on how to use ChatGPT to make your life a lot easier. And I'm really not on that old school of thought that, oh no, don't have ChatGPT. I tell my students, I'm giving you an hour in the class, go on to ChatGPT, find me this, and then analyze it. You know, if you can't beat them, you got to join them, and you got to be one step ahead, I feel.
You know, I sit on the advisory board of a couple of these educational institutions, and someone said about ChatGPT, a very senior former vice chancellor, ban it. And I said, no, you can't do that at all.
It's too late for that now. It's gone far ahead. You know?
Absolutely. But my next question is that what changes do you foresee in the academic landscape in the next few years?
Oh, that's a very macro level question. So I think it's getting more and more difficult, you know, not just talking about India, but globally. Because number one, finding a research gap and publishing gets more and more difficult because, you know, thousands of PhD scholars all over the world are producing so much research. So finding a literature gap becomes more challenging. And yet, on the other hand, universities keep saying, you know, publish an A-grade paper every one or 2 years, and your promotion depends on that. And then we need credit for accreditation purposes and NAAQS. So there's a lot of pressure on professors all over the world to bring in those A-grade papers. And I'm not so sure, you know, if this is such a good thing, you know, and I think professors should be given the option that do you want to go into a research track or a teaching track, because there are some people, amazing teachers who can influence, you know, the next generation of leaders out there and don't necessarily have to do too much research. So I think it's going to get even more challenging at a macro level because institutions have their own pressures. They need accreditations, they need reputations and whatever. And then the pressure comes on the professors, the faculty, to produce tremendous amount of research output in a short period of time. It's difficult, yeah.
Well said, well said. So I'm going to now move to the next few questions are about your books. You've written and published 18 books.
Correct.
Tell me about some of these books and what drives you to write?
So I'm producing a book every 9 months, which is faster than a baby, which takes 9.5 months, right? what drives me? I don't know, craziness. I just can't not write. So even if I'm on a holiday, you know, I went to a women's only retreat recently. And so we had a little bit of downtime, you know, free time hour in the evening. And I just go straight on my laptop and start writing. And they were like, why are you bringing your work with you? And I'm like, no, it's not work. For me, this is relaxation. And this is the way I unwind, you know?
Right.
So it's just in my DNA. I have so many thoughts, so many ideas, and just need to get it out there. And then now that I've got this amazing network with a lot of international scholars, the way we bounce ideas off each other, that's too, you know, hikes up the adrenaline. It's really, really exciting, especially when you start winning international prizes, you know? So that means people are taking credence of what you're doing. So what motivates me? Intense curiosity about the world around me and then trying to figure it out in my mind, which then therefore leads to a research paper or a book. And I must add one big shift that one professor helped me take from the corporate to the academic world when I was doing my PhD. He said, Payal, you keep trying to find solutions. You know, a research paper is not always about that. It could be about asking the right question.
Right.
So I did a paper with them and it got published in a very good journal. And in fact, at the end of the paper, we basically asked a lot of questions. Why is this not happening? Why is this happening? And whatever, whatever. So intense curiosity, I think, is the motivation. And of course, you know, writing in English is all, I mean, I was vice president editorial of one of the leading editorial teams in the country. So of course, English is a great passion for me and writing from the beginning.
And, you know, question I've often asked authors, do you follow any routines or any rituals when you write?
No, I just write whenever I get time.
Okay.
So if I have a day, which is, you know, I have certain lectures or certain family commitments, and then I'll intersperse that with, okay, I've got 40 minutes now, so let me get onto the computer and let me start writing. That's it. It's nothing very structured. It's just whenever I get the time. It's my oxygen. It's my oxygen.
Fascinating. So time for two more questions. My next question is of the 18 books you've published, are there any books that are close to your heart? And if so, why?
So, as I mentioned, that Asian mentoring book, of course, that was very special to us. We got chapters from China, Japan, Sri Lanka, you know, India, Pakistan. So that was very dear to us. But one book I've recently published, I must mention, which is Emotions in the Classroom, which I've done with a professor from France, US and UK, and Canada, sorry. And in that, we're arguing that, you know, why is it that B schools all over the world are focusing on, you know, one part of the brain, the analytical part, and not on the other part of the brain, which is more creative. And, you know, so you may get the odd professor in the world who does a course, starts a course with meditation or does some mindfulness. But we're arguing, why is this not integrated into curriculum? Because the leaders, they're going to be leaders out there, corporate honchos, and you know how much stress there is out there.
Yeah.
And if you train them about mindfulness and, you know, being good to the people around you, your followers, what a difference it can make.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, so this book is about that we need to accept emotions in the classroom, manage them, and not just for the MBA students, but for us as faculty, right? We have to be examples, exemplars. That's a very special book, yeah.
Very interesting. Very, thank you. And my last question to you, you know, you mentioned that you're currently working simultaneously on 5 books. Can you give us a little sneak peek on what you are really writing on?
So, number one, may I say your questions have been very interesting, very well thought out of. So one of them that I'm currently doing is with 2 XLRI professors. It's on critical and ethical thinking for MBA scholars. Mm. Again, it's an Emerald publication. It's 3 volumes. 2 volumes have already come out. The third volume is on its way. And then we're planning a 4th volume, which is for faculty only, so they can come up with actual case studies, you know, to help them in the classroom. So that's one of the sneak previews that I can give you.
Fascinating. Thank you. And on that note, thank you so much for speaking to me about your own amazing journey from a corporate leader to, in your words, an accidental professor. Thank you for speaking to me about diversity, equity, and inclusion, a subject that is close to my heart as well. Thank you also for speaking to me about your books. Thank you again.
So I'd just like to add, Asantosh, that I did start my career trajectory as a journalist, as I mentioned, and I work very closely with in a very dark part of India at that time, which is Bihar, very underprivileged, very lawless. So I work very closely with women activists, children activists, and people like that as a journalist. It was a very tough 10 years, but if I had a rebirth, I'd do it all over again.
Amazing. Amazing. More power to you then. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
I really
you so
appreciate
much. Thank
it.
You. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.